This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So this is, these images are of a human embryo in the first stages of development, starting from the fertilized egg and going through the blastocyst stage. So here we're in the compacted morula, and then there's going to be a switch pretty soon. You'll see here the blastocyst is expanding. It's quite beautiful, I think. And it's due to a collaborator of mine and a former postdoc of mine who now work together. They're embryologists and help women have babies who have trouble otherwise. So this is an embryo that was created for reproductive purposes. So we can see these things happen. The embryos are obviously transparent, so you can see every cell. And yet, there are a lot of things we don't know about these early stages of human development. And I'm actually a high-risk obstetrician, so I actually take care of people who are much later in development, moms and their babies, than this. But we are more and more recognizing the complications of pregnancy and even postnatal complications and health risks stem from these very, very early stages, which led me on my research work to really want to focus this early. It's typically, so reproductive endocrinologists do this kind of work with embryos, and since I'm not one of those, but I appreciate that what they're doing is really important for what I see in the clinic. So taking things a little bit more slowly, and again, it's from the same two people that we have these images. These are snapshots. So basically, this is what a human embryo looks like at 2 days, 3 days, 3.5 days, 4, 5, about 6, and about 6 here. This is later. This is a very unusual picture. This actually comes from Mana Parast, who was going to be here but had a family emergency, so she couldn't make it. She's a perinatal pathologist, and very rarely, it's basically by accident, someone has a hysterectomy, gets their uterus out, and they don't know they're pregnant. And rarely the pathologist will see something like this. And so these are the parts of the embryo a few days later after the beginning of implantation. And this is early enough that even though we do give people pregnancy tests before doing any surgery on them, this is so early that it doesn't come back as being positive. So again, so these various different stages of early development, and we really still don't understand a lot of this process. So, you know, what are our sort of rationales for wanting to study this? So one is we know that, or we hope, that we can optimize development of any given individual by giving them the right environment from the very earliest stages. And there is more and more evidence that these very early stages are affected by maternal health, by things like maternal or paternal age, and other sort of environmental factors. What the mom, for example, is exposed to. But we don't have definitive answers. And without actually asking the question in a rigorous way, we would never be able to come up with the answers. And as I discussed a little bit before, there are effects on pregnancy and prenatal health. There's also effects we know on miscarriage and even on just basic fertility, the ability to get to the point where you have a recognizable pregnancy. So the next question is, why is it so hard to study this? We can see this in a dish. And actually, the reason I have that movie is that more and more, the most successful IVF clinics actually take images like this of every single embryo. And then they sort of, if a woman has many embryos developing, they will score those embryos on their morphology and sort of how fast they get through different stages of development. And then they'll pick the best ones, and those lead to the best successes in pregnancy. But, you know, the problems are that to do research, we have to think of a lot of important ethical questions. So, for example, is collection of gametes and early embryos ethical? Is it legal where you live? Can donors be compensated in any way? In terms of culturing embryos, can they be cultured? And if so, how long can they be cultured? And again, there's legal and ethical and scientific barriers to that. And then finally, this is really becoming a big thing. You might have heard of three-parent babies and things like that. You know, is it, again, legal, ethical, doable on a practical scale to do genetic manipulation of embryos? And if so, for what reasons can you justify that manipulation? And then very practically, early embryos are very small. The human embryos that I showed pictures of are less than about 100 cells. And so detection methods, you know, in the past were not sensitive enough to actually do any rigorous studies on them. So now, mammals, all mammals kind of go through those stages of development, and everybody sort of learns in elementary school that you look like a mouse or you look like a chick until a certain point in your development, and it's actually surprisingly late. The problem is what you look like doesn't always reflect the underlying, what we call regulatory networks that sort of drive that development. And so a lot of aspects of human development are not very well represented in animals. And Mana and I work very closely together, and we work on a lot of projects involving placental development, which is that interface between mom and baby. And in particular, placental development in the human is very divergent from any other mammal or any other animal. And so there are a lot of placenta-specific diseases that only humans get. So it makes it very hard to get any meaningful information from animals. And we actually recently published a paper where you looked at human placental development compared to mouse placental development on the gene-by-gene level and found wide divergences of what we call master regulatory genes even very early in development. Another organ that's really particularly different in human is brain development. And then physiology and control of labor also is very divergent between humans and other animals. So the two biggies in terms of pregnancy complications that affect the health of the baby and the mom are preeclampsia and preterm labor, and they're pretty much human-specific. All right. So now, not all hope is lost, because we actually have made some amazing advances, not just our labs, of course, but in the wider community, that have allowed us to look at small samples. So here, I'm just showing some images from Heidi Cook Anderson's lab. She's actually on the other side of our lab, and we also work with her very closely. These are just beautiful images of human embryos that are stained with some of these early master regulatory genes. And you can see, if you sort of imagine back to those bright field pictures of the blastocyst, it looks like a little soccer ball with a little area at the side, which is what's going to become the baby. But you can see that different cells express different genes. It's not, each cell actually has its own little signature that's very specific. So we can look at proteins. So these are staining proteins. These are microRNAs. Mon and I have a great interest in microRNA research, and we have found recently some microRNAs that are very specific to very early placenta, and we've successfully gotten a pretty tricky method to work where you can look at individual microRNA molecules in early placental tissues here. And then also a big thing that's happened overall that's been really advancing cancer research as well as research in reproduction is single cell sequencing. So you can take a single cell and you can ask which genes are active and inactive in that single cell. And this is one way we look at this data. If you think about this as being like a graph, the genes kind of go along this way. So gene 1, gene 2, gene 3, et cetera, and there's about 1,000 genes here. And then each little area here is a different cell. So here, this is actually data that Mon and I generated together on an early human placenta. And you can see there are different types of cells that basically have a different footprint. Okay, so these are helping us discover new types of cells and also cells and how they relate to each other. All right, so so we have all these amazing things we can do, but we can't really manipulate human embryos in an experimental way with any degree of precision, obviously. We have a lot of generous women who have donated their discarded embryos after they've completed their families, but there's not much we can really do with them, partly because of the limitation in time that we'll discuss further and hope to get your input on, but also just because if we want to change the expression of genes, you have to go through experimental procedures that take weeks to months, and we don't have that timeline. So what have people done? So historically, people have taken cells from the human embryo and grown them in a dish as cell lines. So if you've heard of human embryonic stem cells, for example, they come from the little nub of cells that would otherwise become the baby, and you can grow them for years and years in the dish. Those are human embryonic stem cells. Trophoblast stem cells are the cells that are kind of from the outside of that soccer ball. Up until early this year, it had not been possible to culture human trophoblast stem cells in the dish. It just hadn't happened. There have been mouse ones for about 10 years, but there were some breakthroughs, most notably from a lab in Japan. And now everybody is very excited because now we have a better model in the dish to look at early placental development. There are some other types of stem cells. Parthenogenetic stem cells are ones that come from embryos that were not fertilized. You can actually trick an oocyte, an egg, to think that it's fertilized, actually, and it develops, becomes that blastocyst-like structure. You can make stem cells using the same procedure as human embryonic stem cells, but we know from animal studies they would never develop into a viable fetus. But they do have lots of properties similar to embryonic stem cells and are useful potentially for specific uses. And then induced pluripotent stem cells, these were first generated in about 2007, so it's been about 10 years now, first in mouse and a year later in human. These are where you can take a somatic cell or a cell from other places in the body, the blood, the skin, and you can convince it to reprogram itself to look very similar to an embryonic stem cell. And you do this by turning on specific genes very highly for a short period of time. So when these were first identified, there's a lot of excitement because then you can make essentially a pluripotent stem cell like an embryonic stem cell without using an embryo. We and others have found since then that there are some differences, important differences, in both on the genetic level and epigenetic level with induced pluripotent stem cells. But they are a useful tool. All right. So I'll talk about one other type of stem cell that may be of interest, and that's called a cell that comes from somatic cell nuclear transfer. And this is the basic technology behind the three-parent baby. It's basically where you can take an oocyte that is not fertilized. You can take out its own genetic material. So you just basically have a very cool incubation container, essentially. You can take the nucleus from a skin cell, for example, I have here, and you replace the DNA that you took out with this nucleus, and then you kind of poke it. And then it actually starts developing into a blastocyst, and you can then make essentially embryonic stem cells from another person here, and that's called a somatic cell nuclear transfer stem cell. And this comes from work that we did with Shukra Patelapoff in Oregon, who made the first human somatic cell nuclear transfer ESLs. And we were the genomics collaborators, and we found with Shukra that somatic cell nuclear transfer stem cells are more similar to the true embryonic stem cells than those induced pluripotent stem cells are. So these are, in essence, a better model. So those are all things you can do, and you can generate in a dish. Cell lines that you can look at. They're generally grown in what we call 2D culture on a flat dish. There are some studies where we make them into what are called organoids, little balls of cells that behave more like tissues. But up until very recently, we were not able to actually regenerate something that looks like an early embryo. There were two papers that came out late last year, one from Britain, one from New York, where they generated self-organizing early embryos. They would take stem cells. This is in mouse mostly. They would take trophoblast stem cells or similar cells like that, and embryonic stem cells, sort of just mash them together in a dish, and then they would start sort of organizing themselves into something that looked like a blastocyst. So there was a lot of interest in that. However, they didn't get very far. And we think that it's because they don't have the right spatial cues. They're not set up exactly in the right relationship to each other. So Mana and I and Heidi started working with one of the bioengineers at UC San Diego. This is our first kind of attempt at just putting cells into the right relationship and just showing that we can make a spherical structure that kind of looks like a blastocyst. You might say, where is the little nubbin that has the pluripotent stem cells? Well, we haven't gotten that far yet. But we've gotten a little, you know, we've gotten partly there. So, yeah, so what, at least for us, you know, what is our next goal as a group? And I think the field in general is moving in this direction as well. So could we put all of these technologies I've been giving you snippets of together to build essentially a 3D model of the early embryo for research purposes? The point is not to make a viable individual. It is to make an early embryo where you can actually manipulate the cells before you put it together to study, for example, the function of a certain gene in a certain cell type on the development of that early embryo. So what we would use is pluripotent stem cells, like embryonic stem cells or induced pluripotent stem cells, and placental stem cells, like these trophoblast stem cells. The idea is we can manipulate them, and we can actually explore interactions between the cells by purposely changing their spatial relationships. So this is actually where developmental biology initially learned a lot about early cell types. If you look back, there are studies in frog where they would take a certain cell type from one part of the embryo and move it to the other and learn whether it brought its own developmental potential with it or whether it got reprogrammed by its new environment. So that's our idea. We could do this in a very early human system. And then also, of course, we could culture these in different conditions because they're not meant to become, you know, reproductively useful embryos. They're completely synthetic. We could test the effects of nutrients, drugs, other sorts of environmental conditions on early development. And then those cells could also be analyzed using single cell techniques, like I mentioned earlier in the talk. So just I mentioned some of these people, Mana Parast, Heidi Cook Anderson, Alan Gorin, who is a epigenetics expert, and Dalit Ben-Yosef provided the image of the embryo along with Hadar Amir. So now, I thought I'd transition a little bit into one of the topics I think that that we'll be discussing as a group or small groups, which is the 14-day rule. So what is the 14-day rule? Well, I think in 1971, I believe, Mike can correct me if I'm wrong on the date. This is shortly after IVF became a thing. There was a report that was put out called the Warnick Report. And one very interesting thing about the Warnick Report is that it specifically actually, so a group of people came together and talked, and Mary Warnick wrote the report afterwards to say, this is what we discussed and this is what we concluded. So one thing she wrote, and sort of what came out of the group discussion, was that it, in principle, was okay to make a human embryo for the express purpose of doing research on it. And since then, I think people just dropped that idea because we don't do that. I'm not aware of any research groups that do that. So it's when people do work on an early embryo, such as, you know, some of the things I showed you, they're invariably discarded from a family that has done IVF, frozen excess embryos, completed their family, and decided that rather than putting their, you know, just basically putting their embryos in the discard bin, that they want to donate them for research. So that's a very interesting point about the Warnick Report that I actually had not really appreciated until it's very hard to find it, actually, until I dug it up and read it. But it spends a lot more time on what's called the 14-day rule. And basically, this has been the sort of the basis for a lot of legal and ethical guidelines as to the limit, the time limit for culturing human embryos in the dish for research purposes, or actually for any purposes, research or clinical purposes. And they made four major arguments. So we'll go through kind of what the Warnock Report talked about, and then we can discuss as a group kind of whether that's still relevant today. The first is called individuation. And what that means is their argument was that if a given embryo could become twins, then basically it wasn't an individual yet and shouldn't have the rights of an individual. One thing that's kind of interesting, though, is that so twinning can happen at many stages. And of course, I can't read this very well. But basically, here's the scale of days. So this is, again, this might look familiar by now. You get to the blastocyst stage. And then the embryos can split into two. And there's various different types of twins you can get. So if you split early, then you end up with two babies, two bag of waters, two placentas. This is actually the lowest risk condition for twins. If you split a little later, you have two bags of waters, two babies, but one placenta. And that actually is a little higher risk because they have to share, you know, how well kids share. And then if you go later, they actually have to share a bag of waters. And then if you go really late, then they're actually conjoined twins. So these are very, very rare. And so, you know, you can talk about different cutoffs in time, but personally, one of the issues here is that these become increasingly rare. So if this happens in, I think it's 1 in 5 or 10,000 pregnancies or something, does it really matter? You know, is it such a low number that this late doesn't really have any significance? And where do you draw the line in this timeline? So what I'm showing you here is up to, this is greater than 13 days is where you get conjoined twins. Okay, so the next part of the argument for the 14-day rule was organogenesis. So when do important organs form? And the argument was that neural cells started forming at around 14 days or so. Now, you know, I think it's a little bit difficult, and we could parse this through, like, really in a lot of detail. But as we are more and more appreciating, neural development starts very early. And so do you call a neural progenitor cell a neural cell? Or does it have to have the signatures of a neuron before it's called that? Or do you have to wait till there are neurons and glia? So the more we learn about developmental biology, it becomes a little fuzzier. I thought it might be useful for people to kind of see what embryos at different stages kind of look like. So we already talked about this up to 7 days. So this is the blastocyst. I think it's about day 6 or so. The next one here, this is early implantation. And so you start seeing the sort of embryonic disc is over here. The amniotic sac is over here, just starting to form. Then, and so this is primitive streak is what we usually call this. The next steps are gastrulation. So you start forming the neural tube here. And then week 4 here, you start seeing kind of the form of the embryo start developing. However, there are a lot of things that have not really happened by now. So if we look, so in my sort of specialty, we look by ultrasound. And at week 4, we often don't see much. We kind of kid around with patients if we're showing them, oh, here's your baby. Sometimes we can see a little flutter of a heartbeat. Looks like a kidney bean. If you looked really carefully, it will look a little bit scary. Like the face doesn't really look like a face. The intestine actually has gone out of the abdomen because it has to do this really fancy dance to get organized and has to twist and go back in, and it's not back in yet. So if you looked really carefully, you'd see intestine out. So it's still pretty early development. But there is dramatic change, though, as you can see, in the first 4 weeks. In case people, you know, have had kids, obviously somebody's had a kid, this is actually called 6 weeks in pregnancy because we start our count at the last menstrual period, which is 2 weeks before conception. So this is actually 6 weeks of pregnancy is what the baby looks like. Okay. The next argument was on the miscarriage rate. And the argument was that the miscarriage rate was dramatically lower from 14 days on. They actually didn't have much data. So I pulled this data from, I think, 1989, so 15 years or so after the report. And it turns out, in terms of the success of a pregnancy, the likelihood of success, that here's 14 days on the curve. So there is nothing magical about 14 days in terms of risk of miscarriage. And then finally, the fourth argument for 14 days is this phrase, which I think would be super interesting to discuss because I don't really understand it. It says that that at 14 days, essentially, the process of implantation is complete. And so before then, the embryo has no potential for further development, right? So that can be actually interpreted in many different ways. And one sort of interesting sort of foil to that question is the question of what is viability in prenatal development? And that is a very hard question. I every time sort of I'm in the hospital taking care of pregnant women, we have to think about this because what we consider viability is when can this baby successfully live outside of mom? And that dictates a lot of how aggressive we're going to be and what we're going to offer the moms in terms of potentially life-saving procedures for the baby, right? But that line has steadily marched earlier and earlier in development. So it used to be, if you think about JFK, he had a child when he was a president, and that child did not make it because of prematurity. That child was about 32 weeks when that baby was born. We actually don't worry about 32-weekers anymore. They do super well in general. They have a very high survival and a very high what we call intact survival, which in sort of rough terms is when they get to kindergarten, you can't tell them apart from their peers. So that was, early 1960s, right? Then the next watershed was 28 weeks, then it became 24 weeks, and now we have really hard conversations with parents about 22 and 23 weeks because some of those babies survive. And remembering, pregnancy is 40 weeks long, of which the first two are free, right? Because that's before you get conceived. So at 22, 23 weeks, not many, but some babies survive. Most of those have severe handicaps, but not all of them. So how do you counsel people about those limits? So we're learning more and more that there are not hard and fast rules, and also that, one, we are not perfect at dating a pregnancy. Like if we tell you you're 22 weeks, unless we did IVF, we can't be sure of the date of conception. And also, every individual develops at a slightly different rate. So some 23-weekers do great, and other ones really have a hard time because of immaturity. So I think the same question applies potentially to these decisions about what is ethical early on. The other consideration is that as technology gets better, this is not an area that I know a whole lot about because none of us kind of focus on it, but there is the potential that we could build a good enough incubation environment that even for reproductive purposes, it's not completely crazy anymore to imagine that you could develop a baby much longer in the dish for reproductive purposes. And so it begs the question, is it okay for reproduction? Is it okay for research? And again, we start running into these fuzzy areas. So I think that's all I have in terms of slides, but hopefully we'll have a good discussion about these issues.
So I'm going to ask one person from each group to come up and summarize a couple of the key points that came out of your discussion relevant to either to any of the questions asked. We don't have time for every group to cover everything, but we'd like to hear what came out of your group, and we'll interact and respond to that, and hopefully get through all of the groups and have a chance to touch on a variety of issues. So one group has volunteered to be the first group, I can see.
Have no teeth.
Okay, which group are you from? The middle?
In the second group.
Okay, so yeah. Section C, group 2. All right, so you are first, C2. Thanks. Okay.
I'll start because we came to no conclusion. We had a great animated discussion, and we talked about that there were the factors were both scientific relevance, financial relevance, emotional relevance, in terms of some of it was semantics. The criteria just was skirting around terms like potential life, you know, and I was mean and baited them with spilling your seed could be considered potential life, you know. So that's an issue that has no real beginning and end. Definitely the term human was significant because this is not an issue that is discussed as strongly with other animals. Seems to be a very human. And one of our members talked about, well, our own decision. And so we talked about, well, who owns these? Because you were very careful to delineate that the embryos were donated. And that's true, but that's not necessarily going to be true in the future or true in other political arenas. And the criteria of what are we going to do for the better good, you notice I'm not giving answers, I'm just delineating these factors that we discussed. The greater good for scientists might be that, well, we're going to cure a disease or a condition. Whereas for someone with political or financial means, might be the greater good would be that's my baby or that's my clone in the sense that you were talking about. I know I mentioned that you didn't use the word clone, which is an emotional laden term, but in one of your examples there where we were introducing the somatic DNA, we were basically talking about a clone. So this is a discussion that we did not come yet to the answer because, Michael, you didn't give us enough time. Obviously, 10 minutes later, we would have had the answer. It's a moot, in some ways, it's a little bit of a moot question now because we can't culture these embryos far enough along. We still have to put them in an incubator called a womb. We don't even have an artificial incubator that'll last long enough. But as you said in the very end of your speech, we've now been able to sustain premature babies much earlier than in the past. So I can see scientifically someday after I'm gone, we're going to have the ability to scientifically culture and sustain an embryo all through 40 some odd weeks or whatever in the laboratory. And that's going to be really important too for this discussion.
So, okay, so thanks, and I thank you for the warning. Next time we'll give you 20 minutes so we can get the answers. But I did just ask for factors to be considered, which you did a very nice job of. And I thought maybe this would be a good point to maybe hand it to John Evans, who might want to respond about factors we should be considering.
Well, let me just talk about, in general, your conclusion, which is you didn't reach a conclusion. And I want to point out that there is a reason why these debates are fraught in society, which is both the extremes of the continuum and the middle all represent important values that many people hold dear. So you could take one end of the continuum, which is that no one should destroy any embryo at any time, no matter what. And that's essentially takes a certain different perspective than is commonly held. Typically, there's a religious version of it, there's a secular version of it. The religious version is something like each embryo, the moment of fertilization was, ensoulment from God. That's a perspective, but the argument the people who argue for that, they argue against the perspective of the Warnock Report, which is that humans are those that have certain capacities, most notably a brain, which has the ability to do all these things we think of as human. And the concern is if we think of humans as having differential value by the capacities that they have, we don't like that either. Yet we want to have health, and we want to have science, and we want to... So the reason that you're not coming up with an answer is that there is no one obvious answer, and most societies have come up with a compromise. And indeed, the 14-day rule, if you haven't noticed from what Louise was saying, there's no bright, shiny, obvious 14, could be 13, could be 15, could be 20. These are compromises, and different societies come up with them in different ways. So it's not surprising you didn't come to a definitive answer.
So a compromise means everybody loses.
Yes.
Okay. Just to be clear, Louise, do you want to comment on the first group's perspectives on factors there?
I actually had a question about for your group in terms of what you discussed in terms of financial considerations, like what those specifically might be, and whether they had any differential importance compared to the other factors that you discussed.
These are all some really good points, but I do want to get on to the other groups as well. And on our way to the next group coming to the microphone, John, I think, will admit that he's not a card-carrying philosopher, but he's told me he caucuses with philosophers. So do you want to talk a little bit about is versus ought in the discussion we just had? And
well,
would you be willing to?
I'm actually a sociologist, and so I study all these things, and I can play any one of the characters you want. I'm not an evangelical theologian, but I can play one on TV. I can put on different hats. I actually want to talk about slightly different, briefly, what you said about these laws, for example. That's just one of the many compromises that the society has made to make. It's a common one, actually, we do all the time, which is there's a certain percentage of the population that believes that you shouldn't destroy embryos. And so one of the compromises has been that they won't pay for it. The Hyde Amendment about abortion in the early 1980s is the same deal, which is the federal government doesn't pay for abortion either. But it's legal. And so, you know, I'm not endorsing one view or the other. I'm just saying that this sort of compromise is a very common way these sorts of things are worked out in society.
Okay, thanks. We'll come back to is versus ought later. Which group are you from?
I'm from the group that's right up front.
Okay, you're A1. Okay.
All right, A1. First of all, I will say that our group came to no conclusions either. I think that... certainly not in the time allotted, and probably not in days and days could we come to conclusions. However, the thing that we focused on, I think, with both of the questions was that difference between reproduction and research. And one of the factors for consideration of reproduction is perhaps the couple who is desperately trying to achieve having a child that... if culturing an embryo for a longer period of time would lead to a more successful pregnancy, that, you know, would that be ethically justified? You know, and what that time would be, you know, we didn't come to any conclusion about that, but could it be longer than, say, the 14-day rule? And, you know, and then for research purposes, perhaps, you know, the times would be different. And again, no specific conclusions. And like this group, when we talked about the genetic modifications, looking at the clinical implications of reproduction and the outcome, you know, then the genetic modifications for health outcomes, we were, I think, more in agreement about. You know, not for having the designer baby that has just a certain, you know, eye color or hair color or something like that. But the issue of costs came up. You know, who then pays for this? You know, will there be insurances for covering genetic modifications, or will this be the wealthy individual who can really afford to have all of the treatments? Will they be those who can have them? And what are the ethical implications of that? So those are, I think, some of the main points we discussed.
Good, thanks. And again, I didn't expect any groups to come up with answers. The question is, what should the factors be? So that was a very nice list. Any comments on?
Yeah, I think disparities are actually an important topic. And I didn't really appreciate until I actually started working with Dalit and Hadar that we handle the right to IVF very, very differently in different countries. So in the U.S., for most states, most places, including California, you have to pay for it out of your own pocket, right? You don't. It's not been deemed that you have a right to have your own biological child. Whereas in Israel, where Dalit and Hadar practice, everybody has a right to three children. And you can try three times each time. So in theory, if you're ultimately successful but not super fertile, you can have three tries for your first child, three tries for your second child, and three tries for your third. So you can have nine cycles of IVF. And it's actually very encouraged in Israel. It's actually very similar in France. My husband's from France, it turns out. And through family, we've learned that in France, I don't think they have quite as many times at bat, but it has been deemed that everyone, no matter what their socioeconomic status, has a right to try to have their own biological child. So if we're going further to genetic modifications and things like that, it becomes actually, it's going to be more expensive. We know that. And then bigger disparities may come up in our particular system.
You'll regret talking about human gene modification because that's the exact specialty I've been writing about for the past 25 years, so I'll try to be brief. So there's been a lot of talk about human gene editing and whether or not we'll be able to modify not only our children, but if you modify one child, you in a very small way modify the human species. If you modify enough children, you've changed the human species. Is that a good idea? It looks like the best way you could actually pull that off is to change the spermatogonial stem cells in a man that produce a sperm and then have people have a sexy old-fashioned way and produce a baby. Footnote, that is the, believe it or not, a Catholic magisterium-approved way of human gene editing. Every other way is totally illicit, but that actually might be, for those who are interested in that. But one thing that people, I think, need to realize is that the only purpose for using human gene editing for your children would be to create a designer baby. What I mean by that is that if you were a carrier of genetic disease and your spouse knew that they were a carrier of the genetic disease, for most of these recessive Mendelian things, you have a 1 in 4 chance of having a child with that disease. There are certain very unusual people who, for whatever reason, can't use PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, because they only reproduce embryos that have this disease. So if you both have sickle cell anemia, you're going to produce embryos that have sickle cell anemia. Okay? So you can use it to treat such people, but what you're really treating is not disease. You're treating the desire of that couple to have genetically related children. Okay? The people could just as easily take an embryo from someone else and gestate that, have the experience of pregnancy, and have a family. So what you're treating there is the desire of people to have genetically related children, which is a value that many people find important, but I think it's important to keep that morally distinct. You could use it to make your children healthier if you knew of some unusual gene variant that protected you against disease and the like, but that's what most people mean by designer. So I think the idea of using this to, avoid genetic diseases, sickle cell and all these well-known diseases, it is so much easier to do it with pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. There's no need, with the exception of these very few people who cannot produce healthy embryos that way, and then what we are treating is the desire for genetically related children, not the disease that the children would have.
Good. So there's a lot more depth we go into that, but we'd be good to hear from other groups. Does group B, you guys are section B, B1, 2, or 3, anybody want to volunteer to? So B2, okay.
So we ended up with some similar factors as those guys. One of the things that we had talked about was having somewhat different considerations of research versus embryos intended for reproduction. And so, for example, for in research purposes, making sure you know, the focus is maybe more on humane treatment of those, of that embryo. So, you know, at what point is there, you know, the ability to feel pain and things like that, making sure that you don't get to that point, though, you know, part of the struggle is always knowing what exactly is that point. Some of it has to be based on the science that we know now, maybe using as an indication what we consider for abortion, the time limits there to be okay is an example of something you could consider. But from the reproductive standpoint, those guidelines being more focused on the person that comes out of that at the end, making sure that they, you know, have the same advantages as an embryo that doesn't go through those processes. So I think we talked about, you know, at what point in culture does the spatial configuration start to have an effect, or, you know, different developmental factors, things like that, that you can't have in there have an effect that would be different from someone who didn't go through that. So, and we also had talked about kind of the same thing that she was saying about, you know, the parents, whether or not they have a say on some of those things. Like, I think, was it you that was saying, you know, maybe they want to be able to let it go out further to, you know, see if they can make that baby happen or whatever, some things like that. But also there's repercussions there as far as how much do these parents really know, you know, how much power do we really give them because they don't, you know enough about a lot of those factors. So, yeah.
Thanks. So any thoughts, especially on this general distinction, reproduction versus research and making those choices?
Yeah, you brought up a lot of really interesting points. So one of the points that I thought this interesting is how much research should one do before one launches something into clinical practice? So IVF came about long enough ago. So we were talking about timelines, so Mike looked it up. So 70s, early 70s for IVF, and actually Warnock Report was 81. But we are still learning things about the effect of IVF on the health of the child. So there are now some early results. There were some funded studies about 5-10 years ago. Some of them are coming out about epigenetic differences between babies from IVF and not IVF. This came about partly because we observed in the clinical setting that more IVF babies have Beckwith-Wiedemann, which is an epigenetic disease. We also know, and we don't understand the mechanism really at all yet, that there's a higher rate of preterm birth and preeclampsia in IVF pregnancies. So we know that there's something that's not entirely benign, but the research had not been done up until now in terms of, you know, what the effect was on the embryo. So same thing if we're talking about genetic manipulation. You might have heard a lot of the considerations, do you have what's called off-target effects, right? So you fix the gene you want to fix, but in that process, you've changed something else about the genome somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And unless you actually kind of do the process and then test embryos, at which point they're not viable anymore, you won't know what that effect is, like how bad that off-target effect is. You might want to know that before you start actually trying to treat a baby. Let's say you agree that people have a right to a genetically related child and you want to fix at least one allele of the sickle cell gene. But you don't want to do that if you're going to induce some other change that's going to cause them to have a worse health consequence, right? So, you know, there's all these sort of linked considerations in reproduction versus research.
Yeah, so very good point. If you haven't worked out in the research first where some of those risks might be, you won't find out perhaps for years, as we were finding out for IVF, some things that perhaps if people had known this at the beginning, they would not have been so quick to adopt IVF. It's hard to tell. Group B1, Jeff.
We had a real difficulty with this. I'll start with that. I think probably everybody has. One of the questions that came up is, what is the advantage of cutting for a longer time in terms of what we can learn and what will we do with what we've learned? Because it's whether the is there a risk of eventually going beyond what you can reinsert back into the womb?
Right. So one of the considerations is many of us believe that implantation is something that is, if you looked at that little graph of the rate of miscarriage, it does go down with gestation. Like if you successfully get to a certain point, you're most likely going to make it. But early on, one of these things is implantation failure, right? And so if we don't understand how normal implantation works, we can't really help women who have repeated implantation failure because we don't know what's going wrong with them, for example, you know, or other people who have repeated miscarriages. There are some associations with maternal health, like people who have hypercoagulability, but we don't really know what's happening kind of right there. Is it really that there's clotting going on, or is there something else entirely that's going on? So we don't have good ways to really treat those people and help them have more successful pregnancies. So it's not necessarily that we do want to culture a baby from beginning to end, but if we don't understand kind of where these pitfalls are in development, we can't really do anything rationally to help people overcome them.
So I guess the answer is that the questions you have that are further out would require culturing further out in order to find out what the mechanisms might be.
So, yeah, imagine, you know, why not the 20-day rule or the 21-day rule? And I just want to point out for everyone when they think about this debate on the way home that many of these debates in the life sciences, they're almost all set up on what's called a slippery slope here, essentially, right? Which is there's the most meritorious action everyone agrees with is fabulous, and at the bottom is dystopian, you know, it used to be Brave New World, now it's Gattaca, your cultural reference changes, but you get the idea. Hunger Games, I don't even know what that is. So with things like human genetic modification, there is a beautiful wall on the slippery slope which has an incredibly sharp, distinct moral distinction, which is changing the genes in a person who currently exists that will not be transferred onto any offspring versus someone's children. It's nice and crisp. People can think through it. It's like a wall. Some debates have no walls. Lady Warnock in England tried to create a wall at 14 days, and it's a pretty weak wall because the moral justification for it is, you know, like a primitive streak, you know, et cetera, et cetera. These are not huge moral distinctions, and so the question is, 14-day? Why not 15-day? Why not 16-day? Why not 20 days? There's no obvious place to stop here. And so I think one of the reasons why the people in the room aren't coming up with a sort of definitive answer is there are not crisp markers. I mean, the one of the few ones left is not up for debate, which is, you know, birth. Okay, well, so that's, you know, clear. But, you know, short of that, you know, this debate is lacking those.
And what is the definition of birth? So
right. We induce babies all the time. So
we only have actually a few minutes left. And if my count is correct, we have five groups left. So do any of the five groups that haven't spoken yet have perhaps a clear black and white line that we should hear about? No, that's okay. Or something to add that we haven't already heard. So this group, C3, I think.
So we don't have a line, but I thought it was kind of an important thing to consider before the discussion gets too heated. That I think was an interesting thing that we kind of talked about was what brought us to this discussion. And I think it's always an interesting consideration to think about what values do people hold, what preconceptions do they have, what relation do they have to this field. So in our group, we have a high school student, a Navy OBGYN, a retired nurse, and a Spanish biologist, as well as, like, some random assorted other people. So those are, like, some interesting lines to consider. And I think it's important for all of us to consider what brought us here, what do we bring to the conversation that might make our perception of this issue a little bit different. But additionally, we also talked mostly about reproduction, and that there are kind of some interesting things to consider. Like, should we be encouraging IVF over adoption, for example, because there are so many kids that are not adopted and are living in very difficult situations? Age for in vitro fertilization, whether you've forethought about this situation, and then also, like, at what point do we cut parents out of the equation? We talked a little bit about the lambs that they're bringing fully to term in a lab. So at what point do we do that with humans? Should we do that with humans? Yeah, and then most of the other things I noticed were just things everyone else was saying.
Good, so there were a few other points we hadn't yet raised. So in the last few seconds, any thoughts?
For people of a certain age, that's the Bokanovsky process from the Brave New World, Born in the Bottles, but I'll stop.
Okay, so cultural reference. Yes. Anything else, Louise-Han?
Yeah, I mean, people are willing to do a lot of different things to have their own children. I think we have to acknowledge that that is sort of an innate drive to do. And both, I mean, there's the issue of carrying a child and there's the genetic issue. They're both very important to many people. And just to leave you with a point that's not sort of related exactly to the technologies I talk about today, but there are now several babies that have been born to women who have had transplanted uteruses, which are not trivial things to accomplish, and they have to be immunosuppressed, some of the considerations is that some of these women will be immunosuppressed until they have a child, and then they may have those uteruses taken out because they don't want to be immunosuppressed for the rest of their lives. So they're having that very significant surgery, and the actual pregnancies are no joke either. They are high risk and things like that. So they're undergoing this very major procedure that is very costly to carry a child, whether it's their own genetically or not. So, we have to acknowledge that this is a very strong human drive that sort of needs to be acknowledged and respected.
Okay, good. So I usually try and summarize at the end. There's a lot of points here, but I'm going to hit two points that I think might be helpful and I hope would help inform discussions you'll have after you leave here this evening. One that I think is extraordinarily important that I mentioned earlier is versus ought, or are things the way things are versus the way things should be. We're trying tonight, from an ethics perspective, to answer the question, what should we do, or to figure out how we should answer that question. And clearly we did not answer the question, what should we do? But that leaves us with a question, this is the second part of, well, who should decide that? And the questions that were raised tonight, most of them are things where you can find a large number of people on either side of the issue. So is the ultimate answer going to be compromises, as described before? That means that, in a way, nobody actually gets what they want, but everybody loses something. But you can look at it as everybody gains something. Or is there some other mechanism, some other way forward? But if anybody thinks these questions are easy and everybody should just think it's your way, I hope tonight helped you see that there's a lot of different perspectives to add to the mix. Having said that, I want to thank our speaker and our panelists, Louise Laurent and John Evans. And I certainly want to thank the audience. You were really engaged and some really thoughtful comments. Much appreciated. Hope you'll join us here again and at the very least talk about these issues with others as well. So thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.